You are listening to Mark Hatmaker Rough and Tumble Raconteur. This is a grab bag of old school Western martial arts, resurrected indigenous ways and empirical musings tinged with a heavy dose of respect, admiration, let's call it hero worship, for these hosses of yore. Hey crew, this is Mark Hatmaker coming to you from the Comancheria. Today let's talk about perhaps a question battery to talk about having lost past ways. This comes from a written version we put up in our blog called Have We Dimmed the Light in the Forest? Was actually a jumping off point, was a novel, The Light in the Forest by Conrad Richter. Let's open with a quote from that novel. Again, it's Conrad Richter, The Light in the Forest. The quote is, "We must be polite. If we look at the skin of a white man," he said, "you can see how thin and weak it is. Even such a small thing as words will bruise and cut it open," unquote. Now, the premise of the novel is we're talking about a young, we'll say Caucasian white captive in the late 1700s, early 1800s had been abducted by during an Indian raid and went and was adopted by a tribe and lived with them. And at some point he was being returned to his family. Now, this was a common occurrence at the time during the warfare in the eastern woodlands, the captives moving back and forth and being repatriating, as it were. And lots of people, surprisingly, weren't as happy about being returned to their home. Again, the quote is from the Pulitzer Prize winning author's 1953 novel, Light in the Forest. Now, the novel, again, tell eastern woodland frontier, the white captive, lived with natives for years, and being returned. Now, before we plunge on, I must get the reader reaction out of the way. As fiction, in all candor, I found it a bit stilted, a bit too Rousseauian, noble, savage, and dialogue, and all other particulars, a fascinating read. It's a bit, it seems like it's aimed at young adults, and I am now officially a 58-year-old man, so on that account, it lacks a little bit of heft. But what I do like weaved through it, though, Richter has done his research here. And there was a market, I guess there were in actuality a market number of white captives who once freed. Well, they would escape from their homes time and time again to return to what one would assume to be a harsher life, a harsher culture, one with less amenities. And yet, again and again, the historical record gives us tale that after these dissatisfied returned to civilization citizens, they wanted to go back. I mean, it was so rife and common, Benjamin Franklin remarked upon the phenomenon. On the pages of our blog, we have actually covered this more than a few times as a jumping off point to kind of get at what we might be missing in something a bit more ephemeral than being able to point to concrete things, because so much of what we do with our rough and tumble work and our unlettered work is talking about specifics and how-tos, but forget there's something a bit more ineffable that goes on. We cover some of this in our upcoming Suaketu program, which is like a morning awareness battery, opening the sensorium. But that's still, even then, it does, it's a pale image of what we're trying to get, put our fingers on here. Now, for this tale, the novel, Richter's plunged heavily into these first-hand accounts, first-hand resources, of which these are numerous. Particularly, it seems that he's using Heckfelder and Zeisberger's early work. If you're familiar with those historical works, you're going to go, you're going to recognize a lot of where he's coming from. In more recent times, Sebastian Younger delved into the subject in his masterful book, in my opinion, might be his best book, Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging, talking about how often it is these perilous and tougher times that creates a greater bond. So he's able to extrapolate beyond. He does mention the moving along with the so-called savage populations. They also talk about other tough times that kind of bond, and people that wind up missing warfare. They miss disasters. They don't like all the things that came along with, but there's something deeper that comes together here. Now, anyway, let's get back to this novel. Let's allow Richter to set the stage for what he was trying to do with the novel. And this is from the preface. So we're not in the fiction part yet. This is him actually laying his theme on the line. Quote, "The author wants to acknowledge further his gratitude to those readers who have sensed what he was trying to do, not to write historical novels, but to give an authentic sensation of life in early America. In records of the eastern border, the author was struck by the numbers of returned white captives who tried desperately to run away from their flesh and blood families and return to their Indian foster homes in the Indian mode of life. As a small boy, he himself had tried to run off to Indian country without the benefit of ever having lived among the savages." He continues on here. "Not that the novel represents the novelist's particular beliefs or opinions. He can understand and sympathize with either side. His business is to be fair to both of them. If the novel has another purpose, it is to point out that in the pride of our American liberties, we're apt to forget that already we've lost a good many to civilization. I'm going to repeat that one. If the novel has another purpose, is to point out that in the pride of our American liberties, we're apt to forget that we've already lost a good many to civilization. He continues, the American Indians once enjoyed far more than we. Already 200 years ago, when restrictions were comparatively with us, our ideals and restrained manner of existence repelled the Indians. I'll repeat that again. Our ideals and restrained manner of existence repelled the Indians. I thought that perhaps if we understood how these first Americans felt toward us, even then, and toward our white way of life, we might better understand the adverse, if perverted, view of some of us by Africans, Europeans, and Asian peoples today. Unquote. Now, again, this is, we're past his quote there. If ideals and restraint repelled them then, imagine applying that vision to the 21st century now, when many do not participate in life. What he's referring to is here our manner of restraint, so many strictures upon the way we move and think and feel, and also ideals. This is something actually referred to again and again. And many other modes of life. Ideals is referring, not down. We're talking ideas. I have a good idea. Let's go get something to eat. I have a good idea. Here's how to move this along. Ideals are abstractions. Ideals are when we think that we're living in the real world and we're talking about, oh, let's talk about progressive parties. Let's talk about Republican parties. Let's talk about this or that, some dancing in the head of a pin aspect of religion. We get into ephemeral, generalized, abstract areas, and we get remarkably attached to them, where when you live a bit closer to things, live a bit raw, live in perhaps in a disaster zone, or perhaps live amongst a tribe where each day is a bit of a struggle for existence, you get a better chance to slough off some of your ideals. And again, this is the further we get from having to really participate and be in something, we can fall into living in ideals and maybe not even realize it. Many of us, whether we realize it or not, spend portions of our life not really participating. We allow tiny screens to stand in as council fires. These screens stand in for celebration dances. They stand in for face-to-face interaction. You still feel strongly for these ideals that you can survive, that they can survive in our absence. But now the clickety-clack of a keyboard comment or thumbing in an emoji, this icon satisfies this participatory exchange. And I think many of these people are missing the fact that there's something visceral, flesh and blood, and being looking people in the eye and moving, participate, even if it's work, even as a grinding corn against a matate, it's something a bit different. Now, Richter and Younger and these other authors are telling us that often much of what we may see as a bonus are chosen bars in a prison cell. Richter opens his novel with this extract from the poet Wordsworth, quote, shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy, but he beholds the light, and whence it flows, he seizes it in his joy, unquote. Now, that prison house there, each day, as we say, don't do this, don't do that, and, you know, sit up. And this isn't against society at all. I mean, let's get this straight. I get it. I enjoy society. I like the nice orderly line whenever I'm trying to pick up something and make sure we understand there's a pattern to what's going on. And that's not to say we don't find this also present in some of these societies, but I think we can go further and find out, Richter and Younger and other asking us to go, are some of these a bit too far? Richter asks us to pay attention, to question all aspects of our civilization, life, and to ask and determine, is this really a boon, or is it mere fashionable ideal, or is it a benefit, or another brick in a self-constructed cell? To be clear, the question is never useful in the abstract spirit, meaning with this, whenever we start saying, you know, what's wrong with society today is, you know, what all these people should do. No go. We don't need to do it that way or in the other directed spirit. I'll tell you what's wrong with Ted. He needs to do this. Stop it right there. That's not how questioning can be of benefit to us, to you and me. We need to question our own prison houses, our own prison cells, our own habits. We need to question ourselves, our own souls, if you'd like, where these are the only places the questions that matter. Are these the only places we can address them? These are the only ones we can give an answer to as to whether they really are useful or not. And we're the only ones that can choose to tunnel out of this or that circumstance if we deem them idealized restraints. Let's look to a few mundane examples from the novel to give a flavor for how these questions may provide an escape key if one is needed. Here's a quote from the novel. The boy was about 15 years old. He tried to stand very straight and tall when he heard the news, but inside of him everything had gone black. It wasn't that he couldn't endure pain. In summer, he would put a stone hot from the fire on his flesh to see how long he could stand it. In winter, he would sit in the icy river until his Indian father, smoking on the bank, said he could come out. It made him strong against any hardship that would come for him, his father said. Unquote. Now, to be clear, I don't think that such practices are necessary. I mean, you don't have to place a hot stone on you. I know there's a big fashion now for hot and cold showers or plunges and stuff. I'm not saying they're not useful at the same time. But I do find that practices of purposeful hardening or robustification of all stripes can go a long way towards the improvement of both the physical and mental character. But notice in the novel, as it often seems to be overlooked, the novel's example was not to improve cold tolerance or heat tolerance. That's not what it's all for. That's often what we're doing today. We've compartmentalized too much. We take the cold showers so that we can stand the cold, so on and so forth. In the novel, we're saying it was to teach us strength against hardship. See, I know many, many a cold shower practitioner, many a sauna user who tout the health benefits, yet they still bitch about politics and traffic and, most baffling, all the weather. Now, one would assume that robustifying to hot and cold was intended to robustify beyond the mere Instagram game of the practice. It is either of value or it is not. Seems integration, the whole is the thing. Seems the spirit is the thing. All the training, whether it was being done in a tribe or within ourselves, how does it apply to the whole? If it's only for that one specific thing, just really simply no point in it. Another quote from the novel: never would he go to this enemy land. How could he exist among a race of aliens with such slouching ways and undignified speech? How could he live and breathe and not be an Indian? Unquote. Slouching ways and undignified speech are hallmarks of many of these accounts from true journals. Noticing, always walking around slouching. And pretty much speech stripped of any kind of style. This was being remarked on in the 1700s and 1800s. Thought experiment. If we possessed a time machine, would we expect to see more slouching then or now? More dignified speech then or now? I think I'll lift my head up from my smartphone after keying in my dignified emoji and ponder this question. Let's do another quote from the novel. The Indian and deer would die in such confinement, but the white man flourished in the stale, sickly air of the house, like fleas in his walls and boars in the cabin logs. He could arise refreshed from a suffocating bed of feathers, high as a turkey roost off his mother, the earth. He could even survive that instrument of torture called a bolster, aka a pillow, which bent white people from the straightness of the Indian, curving their necks forward like a crane. Unquote. Now, think of this. I'm just curious. I wonder how many complaints of a poor night's sleep are relics of the necessities of a sleep pillow configuration, the blanket weight, the mattress tone, my sleep app, my sleep number. I mean, I'm not saying that all these things are in that bed. I'm just saying, how many are surprised what a week's backcountry camping does to the usual around the coffee pot I slept for shit last night complaints? Richter, and again Younger, asks us to question not just society in general, question all the artifacts we got within it. It doesn't mean all these things are net bad. I am not saying that at all. It just asks us to look at, well, everything. Let's go to another quote. Later, Andy Goff, the shoemaker, arrived. The tailor's fitting and fuzzing had been trial enough. The clothes he made were ugly as Alex, but the shoemaker's was worse. The boots he pounded out there were like half-hollowed logs. They gripped the boy's feet, wedged his toes, cramped his ankles. He felt that he stood in millstones. How could white men endure such things when they might run light and free and in their moccasins or barefoot? Unquote. There's been many arguments against footwear before, and again, I don't think all of those hold water, but we do. Let me offer this. I know a man, a good man, who wears combat boots day in, day out, be it for fashion cachet or a blinkered. I'm tactical ready man. I do not know, but I am also privy that he has complaints of foot problems and that he self-confesses to running and jumping poorly. Again, that's no argument against footwear. I mean, I wear shoes. I'm just reminding us how wide we should ask our questions about possible prison houses. Let's go to another quote. And this one might be a kicker. Quote, on the seventh morning, he must sit, a captive between his father and Aunt Kate in what they called the Great Spirit's Lodge, with the strong scent of the white people and the clothing about him. The whites were very childish to believe that the God of the whole universe would stay in such a closed-up and stuffy place. The Indians knew better, that the Great Spirit loved the freedom of woods and streams where the air blew pure, where the birds sang sweet and nature made an endless bower of praying spots and worship places. Unquote. Again, now that idea about everywhere is a worship spot, that idea pops up in true accounts again and again and again and again. I have to admit, this idea sings to me. Everywhere is a praying spot. Everywhere is a gratitude spot. Everywhere is a seeing spot. Each step is a sermon. It is novels such as this one, true accounts such as those that I've mentioned that fuel my own stepping sermon, be it old school rough and tumble combat, old school physical culture conditioning every day, or we just learned that every day is this day. This is the one we're living right now, man. We don't need to idealize somewhere, sometime. This is when things will be better, when I retire, when I get to heaven, whenever I blah, blah, blah. No, now. This is it. This even comes down to even me living at my boyhood Tarzan Jones wannabe thing, but looking to the real ones in the world who live contact with life lived raw and saying, how do we get a piece of that? We must ask our own questions, all right? I can't ask them for you. We must experiment with life outside of the prison house of our own lives, not someone else's, and saying this is what they should do. No, what should you do when you answer your own questions so we can determine the answers to these questions ourselves? And once we have the answers, let's keep those habits that sustain us and kick off those habits that don't fit us, like a pair of millstone boots. Don't let your feet get cramped up, all right? I'll put a link in here, so if you'd like to take a look at the print version of this or dig further into these resources where we're looking at old school ways here. And in the end, let me close it out with a Comanche benediction, which is basically respect or honor, my brothers and sisters. Take care of yourselves. Well, if you dig what we just discussed today, I'd like to invite you to like and subscribe to the podcast. Hell, support it if you want. I'm not your dad. Do what you want. And if you're a glutton for punishment, just visit our website, extremeselfprotection.com. You'll find links to the blog, all of our products, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of more pages of like musics.